question. Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Morning and welcome to this third argument of this October 13 panel of the Court of Appeals. We are hearing cases today by Zoom on the electronic digital platform rather than live. So counsel, just a couple of different housekeeping matters regarding that. Even though we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only making an audio, not a video recording of the proceeding. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that the audio recording can keep track of who's attached to which argument. If there's any technological issues along the way, if you have difficulty hearing or seeing anyone, just raise your hand or somehow bring it to our attention so that we can pause the proceedings and sort out the technology. And counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, and 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you'd like to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Before we begin, I suppose I should indicate what exactly we're here to hear. The matter before us is the case of Brangen versus Wietzel. And you can correct my certainly awful pronunciation of either or both of those names as you engage in your arguments. All right, counsel, now you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Fiscom, and I am the attorney for Robert Brangen, who is the appellant in this case. And I guess the first comment I want to make is that throughout the argument, there's going to be an important fact that we may return to. And that fact is simply that there is a valid quitclaim deed. It's of record, recorded and
registered. Where is it? Where is that quitclaim deed? It's apparently it's not been recorded, right?
No, that's not correct. It has been recorded. There is a finding in one of the court orders that it has been recorded, and it is a matter of record.
So the recording detail is in the record.
There is a finding of fact that it's been recorded. It's not. I don't recall if the recording detail.
So was it introduced as an exhibit in one of those motion hearings?
It must have been because the court made a finding of fact. It made several findings of fact about the quitclaim deed, and it could have only done so by looking at the quitclaim deed.
Well, you're familiar with the record. Was the quitclaim deed offered as part of an affidavit in those motions?
I believe it was in connection with a 2017 hearing and order, yes.
So recorded copy or a non-recorded copy was attached?
I don't know the answer to that question.
To whose affidavit was it attached?
It would have been attached to Mr. Branchen's affidavit. But the point is, regardless of whether the deed was or was not recorded, it does show that Mr. Branchen owns 100% interest in the property. Whether it's recorded pertains to the rights of third parties who may engage in a transaction without notice of the deed, but as between these parties, the deed was tendered. It was a subject of a court proceeding. The respondent never argued that it was invalid, or that she argued that it failed for lack of consideration and that it failed to meet the requirements of an inter vivos gift of personal property. But in any event.
But what does the existence or the non-existence of the deed have to do with the timeliness of your motion to reopen the judgment?
Well, quite a bit. The argument with respect to timeliness, I think, reduces to this. In 2017, the district court said that Mr. Branchen owned 100% of the property. It made that finding based on its analysis of the deed. In 2018, in July, about a year and a half later, the court flip-flopped. It changed its mind. And then in 2020 or 2021, the court said that the timeliness for the measurement of timeliness for the motion, it should begin running in 2011. And that makes no sense at all. That's an abuse of discretion because it's a decision that is against
the law. Whether the time starts in 2011 or 2015, the question is simply, did you make your motion within a reasonable time, right?
The time should have started either in July of 2018 or it should have started in August of 2020. Now, this court has held in another case that was cited in our brief that a motion under 518.145 subdivision 5.2 that was brought, or subdivision 2.5 that was brought 24 months after the entry of the order, that was timely. So here we're talking 27 months. And
what about focusing on 2015? There was litigation at that point to enforce the sale provision.
Yes.
So that by 2015, whether he had a deed, whether your client had a deed or not, he knew that she was claiming that the judgment should be enforced. Now, if you don't want the judgment to be enforced, time to make the motion. So he could have made the motion in 2015, couldn't he?
Well, he was successful in 2017. In 2017.
How about 2015? He couldn't he make the motion in 2015?
He did bring motions, and the court disposed of those motions in 2017, and it ruled that he owned the property. So if we have an order from 2017 that's in effect until July of 2018 that says he owns the property, it would make no sense for him to bring a motion because it would be superfluous. It would subject him to sanctions. The court said, look, we're done. You own the property. And then
were there appeals on all of these decisions the trial court makes over the years?
Yes, there was. And the most recent appeal.
I know there were on some. Were all of them subject to an appeal?
There were many orders in the case. The order that's the 2000 July 2018 order was subject to appeal. This court entered an order on August 12th, 2020, and it simply said that a motion needs to be brought pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.145 subdivision 2. It didn't preclude Mr. Branchin's rights to bring such a motion. So that motion was brought immediately. And the question is a reasonable time frame to reach back to 2011? No, it's not, because of the 2017 order. Is it reasonable to reach back to 2015? No, it's not, because of the 2017 order. Now, what happened is that the district court, in its December order, didn't even mention the 2017 order and the impact that would have on Mr. Branchin's expectations and his substantive due process rights. In February, the court issued an order, and it tried to dismiss that by saying there was confusion about that. Well, there wasn't confusion. The order is clear. There was no confusion articulated at the hearing. And the problem is, we're not in a position to review that because the court failed to make a transcript. The district court is a court of record. It is obligated to record its proceedings, and we're given specific instructions that we cannot record its proceedings. Well, of course, we didn't, but the court didn't either. So the court has made two errors. If the 2015 order is correct, then the 2017 order cannot be correct, or vice versa. But it also erred in failing to record the proceeding and then saying that, well, the 2017 order doesn't matter because there is some confusion about that. We weren't confused. But I'd like to address the other component.
Well, there's the procedures. They're not for you can agree to what isn't in a transcript for appeal purposes.
Well, the court.
Right? There's that kind of procedure available.
Well, maybe so, but nonetheless, the court didn't make a transcript. there was no confusion, and the 2017 order is not confusing. But the court also addressed essentially what is the likelihood of success. And to do that, it said, well, okay, even if the motion was timely, it wouldn't succeed, and here is why. And it cited the doctrine of accord and satisfaction, which really is a term of art that's covered by the Uniform and the quitclaim deeds aren't included. They're excluded by definition. But more importantly, the court got it backwards. The doctrine of satisfaction and accord is asserted by the person who tendered the instrument to support the argument that the debt is paid in full because the instrument was tendered. There's no reverse application where you say to the person who received the instrument, okay, now you have to prove the burden that the other party should have proven. What Mr. Branchen proved satisfactorily to the court is that he's the true owner of the property because he has a quitclaim deed saying that he owes 100%. So to then, after the fact, say, well, you know what, this doesn't comport with the doctrine of satisfaction in the court. Read the doctrine and read the case. The unpublished case that the court relied upon has nothing to do with this case. It involved a commercial contract. It involved parties who, in part, had tendered a quitclaim deed. And the court said, yeah, the quitclaim deed is valid, but you still owe more money because of this contract. Mr. Branchen isn't saying that. He's not saying that Ms. Weitzel owes him more money. He's simply saying, look, you gave me the deed, and I own whatever your interest was, I now own. Now, what the district court inadvertently did was to create two classes of quitclaim deeds. On the one hand, there are quitclaim deeds between parties who were never married. That's one class. On the other hand, there's another class of a quitclaim deed between parties who once were married but now are divorced. And we think that's inappropriate. The Karen case touches on this somewhat. It's kind of a paternalistic reading of the statute and say, well, okay, so you were married once, you gave him a deed, but we're gonna rescind it, or we're gonna say, and the court didn't rescind it, we're just gonna ignore it and say that he, you know, still has to pay the money. I mean, the question we need to ask is, when he got the deed, what was it that he owned? And the case law that we've cited says he owns whatever Ms. Weitzel's interest was in the property. And I think the easiest way to understand that is to say, okay, what if she had given the deed to somebody else, which she could have done, because they own the property as co-tenants. They each own a 50% share. She could have given her interest to anybody. Well, what if she had given her interest to somebody else and then wanted to undo that? Can she go back to the divorce court and say, you know what, you gave this to me, so take this deed away? No, she can't. Mr. Branchen should be in the same position as that other person. We're not trying to change the terms of the divorce decree. We're simply saying, okay, these are the terms, but after the divorce, 10 years later, you gave your interest to me, which is documented by a valid quitclaim deed that was analyzed by the district court and not rescinded or not vacated. So we still have that problem. There is still a valid deed that underlies Mr. Branchen's rights in this process. Now,
what was his interest? I mean, he had tenants in common, so he had a 50% interest, but there was also an encumbrance on that interest, wasn't there, by the judgment?
Yes, and when he received...
And that encumbrance was that it was subject to restrictions in terms of at some point it had to be sold, and the restriction of proceeds divided. That's part of...
Was well, it Sure, but that was taken care of by the quitclaim deed. The person...
Well, are you saying that the court's restrictions on property can be conveyed away by a quitclaim deed?
Oh, sure.
In a family law case?
Yes, if the restriction inures to the benefit of a party to the case. And we're not the only people saying that. That's very clear in the Nelson v. Quaid case. Now, I want to point out that counsel kind of fabricated some language in the case. He said that it referred to the doctrine of accord and satisfaction, which it really doesn't. It's a contract case involving maintenance and property. But yeah, very, very clearly, if somebody receives an interest in property pursuant to the judgment and decree, they can convey that. And if you convey all right, title, interest, and equity, then yes, with respect to that party, the encumbrance is dissolved. I mean, that happens all the time. People, if we said no, this doesn't work this way, there are probably thousands of deeds that would be invalid, because when people are divorced and then they want to sell property, they don't return to court and ask for permission to do it. If they want to sell a car, they don't have to return to court and ask for permission to do it. They transfer their interest. Now, in this case, obviously, consideration isn't an issue. We look at a quitclaim deed based on the four factors that are articulated by the Minnesota Supreme Court and statute, and those were all satisfied. The district court made that very clear. The only problem apparently is that, well, you didn't bring a motion. You didn't describe the motion to say that it was brought under 518.145 subdivision 2.
Thank you, Mr. Fiskum. Your time has expired. Unless there's any other questions from the panel members, we'll leave you to make any other comments during your rebuttal period.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. Michael Boulette here on behalf of respondent Therese Weitzel. Your Honors, at the heart of this case, what we have is a 1999 divorce decree that required sale of a home and division of proceeds. Since 1999, Mr. Branchen, appellant, has been ordered to sell this same home in 2015, in 2016, in 2018, in 2020, and most recently through the denial of his motion for amended findings in 2021. Five separate orders all telling Mr. Branchen precisely the same thing. This home needs to be sold, then the proceeds must be divided. In response to each of those orders, Mr. Branchen's made some version of the same argument, which is that this 2011 quitclaim deed released him from his obligation to sell the home and divide the proceeds. The relevant law is not in question. Everybody has acknowledged at each phase of the case that Minnesota Statute 518.145 subdivision 2 governs Mr. Branchen's request. In this particular appeal, we're even more clear that subdivision 5 of 518.145 governs Mr. Branchen's request, and that provision tells us that parties may obtain a release from a binding court order, in this case an injunction requiring him to sell the home, upon proof of satisfaction, release, or discharge. Now, Mr. Branchen's made some version of this argument all along the way, but in the 2020 motion he brought, following affirmance by this court of earlier orders, Mr. Branchen argued just that, that he's proven a satisfaction, release, or discharge, and the district court told him he had not. And the district court reached three independent reasons why Mr. Branchen failed to satisfy the requirements of statute. First, it found he simply didn't bring the motion in a timely fashion. 518.145, mirroring Rule 60, doesn't provide a specific time limit for motions to reopen on the basis of release, satisfaction, or discharge, but it does require them to be brought within a reasonable period of time. Here, the district court looked at the record as a whole, and it says you have been subject to enforcement motions in 2015, in 2016, in 2018. If you really expect me to believe, Mr. Branchen, that you've never previously sought release or discharge from this, then your motion's simply untimely. If none of your prior motions appropriately raised this issue, you've come to the court too late. 9.5 years after getting your quitclaim deed, 5 years after Ms. Weitzel first brought her motion to enforce.
Well,
reasonableness?
Can you address the argument that the district court's order in 2017 changes the game, that there's, the district court declares that he owns the property entirely.
The district court's order in 2017 should be addressed. And Your Honor, Judge Rush, I think you make a good point. First, we should clarify that order has since been vacated by the district court. So in the July 2018 order by the magistrate, the 2017 order regarding the quitclaim deed has in fact been vacated.
Well, but that's my concern. Before it's vacated, it's not vacated until 2018. So I guess that's maybe the heart of my question. Why wouldn't July 2018 be the starting point of the clock regarding the reasonableness of time to bring the motion? I'm sorry, Mr. Boulet, I'm not hearing you all of a sudden.
Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Now we can, yes.
I think the way I understand the district court's order, Your Honor, is that there isn't a specific starting point on the clock. The district court has not identified one specific baseline and said, because you knew or should have known at this point, your motion now is unreasonable. Instead, what the district court has said is, Mr. Branch, you were on notice in 2015 and you didn't bring that motion. You were on notice in 2016 and you didn't bring that motion. You were on notice in 2018 when the parties were litigating over whether or not that 2017 order should be vacated. You didn't bring that motion. So at each step of the way, Mr. Branchon has had ample opportunity to assert this right, had he wanted to assert this right, and has failed to exercise any of those opportunities. So it's not quite as straightforward as measuring against any particular baseline. It is a matter of looking at the different points at which it would have been logical for Mr. Branchon to interpose that motion, and the fact that he did not do so.
I think his argument is that the 2017 order made it change the field so that it was no longer necessary to bring the motion until the court changed its mind in 2018. Can you address that argument?
It's a fair enough point as far as it goes, but once the parties re-engage in litigation through the end of 2017 and beginning of 2018, that was yet another opportunity for Mr. Branchon to bring that motion, to say, this was a defect identified to him, that you have not brought a motion. That's precisely why the 2017 order was mistaken. Mr. Branchon could have brought a motion at that point. He did not do so. I think as important, Your Honor, is to understand this in the holistic context.
I'm sorry. I guess I'm still not understanding. And maybe it's just me not, missing the point, but I think the position is that there's no basis, there's no impetus to bring the motion after the district court. I mean, even if you might say it should have brought the motion before 2017, once you get to 2017 in July and the district court renders its decision declaring the ownership of the property, there's no need to bring the motion. There's no basis for it. So if you're going to then later say that it was untimely for you, you were untimely not bringing the motion sooner, why wouldn't 2018 be the starting point to measure reasonableness?
Your Honor, even if it was, Mr. Branchon would still not prevail. Even if
so
we
what are you
for
saying?
The sake of art.
Are you saying that we don't look for a starting point, that we look at all what has happened to determine whether or not timing was unreasonable?
Judge Klapphacke, that's precisely what I'm saying, is that when the statute asks the court to determine whether a motion is brought within a reasonable period of time, it is not asking for a purely temporal analysis. 12 months will always be reasonable. 18 months will never be reasonable. What the statute's asking for is, under the facts of this case, was this motion brought within a reasonable period of time? So to Judge Ross, your question, even if we take 2018 as our starting point, that still means Mr. Branchon waited 2 years in which he knew he was obligated to sell this home and could have brought a motion at any point in time within those 2 years saying, I should be released or discharged. The district court specifically found in that July 2018 order that vacated the 2017 decision that his failure to bring a motion was a critical problem. That same problem was enunciated by this court. So even if we begin measuring from 18, it is not as though Mr. Branchon did not know such a motion was required. Simply elected not to bring it, and instead elected to wait 2 more years and sit on his rights. Timeliness, though, Your Honors, is not the only reason the court denied Mr. Branton's motion. Contrary to counsel's representations, this isn't a case where the court said, the motion's untimely, so I'm done. It denied Mr. Branton's motion on at least two other independent bases. First is the presence of this precise, this exact question in 2015. So Ms. Weitzel brought her initial motion to sell the home in 2015. Mr. Branton interposed as a defense, but there's a quitclaim deed. I shouldn't have to sell because the quitclaim deed exists. He made many arguments very similar to those he reasserted in 16, in 17, in 18, and now before this court. And the court, district court in 2015 said, notwithstanding the presence of this deed, sell the home. That 2015 order wasn't subject to any litigate, was subject only to enforcement litigation in subsequent years. Both parties moved to enforce it at different points in time. Mr. Branton subsequently moved under Rule 52 to amend that order. So he sought amended findings. That motion was denied. A notice of filing was served. And so the time to appeal the 2015 order has since run. As the district court observed in its order, we cannot continue, the district court cannot continue to return endlessly to the same argument after it has been considered and denied on multiple occasions. The district court also had an independent basis to deny on the basis of preclusion. Mr. Branton has asserted this defense before, not just once, but several times. And having found that wanting, and having given that the time to appeal those orders had expired, it was permitted to deny Mr. Branton's request on that basis as well. But more importantly, and I think critical to this case, is the district court didn't stop its analysis there either. It looked to Mr. Branton's motion on the merits, and it held him to precisely the burden that any party seeking relief from a judgment decree is held to. It said, prove to me, by preponderance of the evidence, that there was a satisfaction, release, or discharge of this obligation, such that I should release you from the binding requirement, home sale requirements of the 1999 decree. It looked at Mr. Branton's affidavits. It looked at the supporting exhibits. It took into account the contextualizing statements in Ms. Weitzel's affidavit. And the court, like prior district courts before it and other judicial officers who heard these similar arguments, was unpersuaded. And what it found specifically is Mr. Branton's arguments aren't credible. I don't believe, as the fact finder and as the weigher of credibility, that he's proven satisfaction or release or discharge in this case. So even if we get past timeliness and the fact that Mr. Branton waited at a bare minimum 2 years from 2018 to bring this motion, if we get past the issue of preclusion that he'd raised this defense in prior unappealed orders and lost, and the district court had nonetheless ordered him to sell the home, we still get to Mr. Branton precisely where he is right now, which is on the merits. And the court, looking at the record as a whole, did not believe that there was a release of this judgment and decree. Counsel continues to argue, as Mr. Branton has argued for years, that the court, district court, as a matter of law, was required to treat a quitclaim deed in every instance and under all circumstances as a release or discharge under 518.145 subdivision 2.5. There is absolutely no law cited, nor am I aware of any law that says that a quitclaim deed will automatically and as a matter of law always function as such a release. Here, the district court did the analysis. It looked to the only available case on point, which is Nelson versus Quaid, and found that the contractual elements necessary to demonstrate that the decree had been released were not there. In fact, it went on to find that Mr. Branton's version of events, in essence, that the decree had been released as satisfaction of a bankruptcy payment he purported to have made, was not credible, in no small part because Mr. Branton offered several prior versions of why this claim had been released. At one point it was, she didn't pay child support, and so she released it on that basis. More recently it was, there was a bankruptcy payment I made. She released the home on that basis. All of these changing stories led the court to conclude, as a factual matter, and based on the record before it, that there simply wasn't enough evidence here to determine that the decree had been satisfied, released, or discharged. So although counsel talks about the validity of quitclaim deeds, the court didn't address this case as a question of deed validity because that is not what the statute requires of it. What the statute requires is to ask the question whether the criteria of statute, whether the criteria in 518.145 have been met, whether Mr. Branton met his burden of proof to convince the court that a discharge exists. That he failed to do. So on a factual level, factual findings to which this court defers, matters of credibility that we understand the district court is in the best position to address, Mr. Branchin didn't prevail in the substance of his claims. And so for each of those three reasons, timeliness, preclusion, and the substance of Mr. Branchin's motion, the district court denied his motion. Everything else beyond that, Your Honor, is an attempt to rehash arguments that three different judicial officers have looked at and three different judicial officers have rejected. For that reason, we ask this court to affirm the court's order requiring the home to be sold.
Thank you, Mr. Boulat. Doesn't appear to be any other questions from the panel. We turn then to appellant's counsel for any rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. Mr. Boulat just said something to the effect that there's no law that says
if you could just go ahead and state your name. I didn't mention your name as I introduced you so that we keep track of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Daniel Fiscombe. And again, I'm the attorney for the appellant, Robert Branchin.
Thank you.
Mr. Boulat just said that there is no law that says that a quitclaim deed, I can't remember the exact words, but that it operates to show that an obligation under a judgment and decree has been satisfied. In fact, there is. And we have cited this law in our brief. It's Minnesota Statute Section 507.06. And it says that a quitclaim deed is sufficient to pass all the estate which a grantor could convey by a deed of bargain and sale. And we also cited a case in our brief that stands for the same rule of law, and that is Danielson v. Danielson, 721 NW2D 335-33, and the exact site is on page 339. So if there's any confusion about that issue, all we need to do is look at the statute, and we need to look at the case law. With respect,
here's a question that I have that I raised earlier, and I'm not sure that I'm satisfied in the discussion. Surely a quitclaim deed conveys whatever interest the person has at signing the deed. But in what is the question that is raised here? What was that interest here? And it looks to me like whatever it was a tenants in common, a 50% ownership. But more than that, it was also subject to a judgment and decree that had provisions about sale and division of proceeds. So when you say that quitclaim deed can convey their interest, question that begs the question is, what was the interest here? And isn't the interest here wrapped up into that court judgment that you can't get rid of by simply signing a quitclaim deed?
I disagree with the notion that you cannot get rid of the court judgment by signing a quitclaim deed.
Some occasions you could. I'm talking about this particular one where the judgment says that at a certain date or a certain event, the property will be sold and the proceeds will be divided.
Yes. And 10 years later,
any case law that says that a quitclaim deed in and of itself will satisfy that requirement?
Yes, that's the Danielson case that we cited. I don't think it's subject to reasonable dispute. That is in the Danielson case. I want to mention one thing about the timing, though, and the issue.
Can you give me that citation again?
Yes, it is 721 NW2D 335. And I just want to make a point with respect to the timing. And the Mr. Boulat seemed to suggest that, well, maybe not 9 years, maybe not. All we need to do is look at the court's order dated December 14th, 2020. And it says motion pursuant to the statute is not timely. The motion was filed 9.5 years after the execution of the quitclaim deed. Then the court says 9.5 years is not reasonable. Then the court says, as a question, is it reasonable to wait 9.5 years to file a motion to modify a judgment? Answers the question, no, it is not reasonable. So to suggest that, well, there are all these other points in time, no, we need to look at what the court said, and what the court said is 9.5 years.
Well, we can't just look at what the court said, because various courts have said various things and have changed their minds. So this is just a swamp of court decisions.
Certainly this court has said things and has changed its mind. And that has inured to the detriment of Robert Branshon, whose rights to substantive and procedural due process have been abridged. And yes, courts say things and change their mind. All we can do is look at the order and say, this is what the order says. Is this what we should do? I want to make one other point very quickly, and that's simply this. The burden of proof is not on Robert Branshon to show accord and satisfaction.
If he's bringing an action under the statute to set aside the judgment, then the burden of proof is his, is it not?
It's his burden to show that the quitclaim deed is valid, and he met that burden. But it's not his burden to assert for Ms. Weitzel that the doctrine of accord and satisfaction. That's her. It's not his burden. And so the court reversed that burden. The case, the unpublished case the court cited, is absolutely in a posit. And so we respectfully ask that this court reverse the lower court's decision. Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your submissions and writing and for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted.